My guest is Giles Merritt. Giles Merritt is a Financial Times foreign correspondent for 15 years in his past career, and then an EU affairs columnist on the op-ed pages of the International Herald Tribune for 20 years. In 1999, he founded the prominent Brussels think tank Friends of Europe, which he writes still a fortnightly column called Frankly Speaking. He's the author of a new book, Time Bomb, When Aging Explodes. And welcome to the podcast, Giles.
Thank you.
Right. Well, I'm intrigued, like anybody who's written a book, to ask the author why this topic and why now. You say in the book that we are very conscious of the geopolitics of the world at the moment and all the tension around the world. We're very increasingly conscious of the climate change and the impact of climate change, but we're not really at all aware of the issue of aging, especially in Europe.
Well, I think it was precisely that, the refusal of politicians right around Europe to focus on this huge problem coming towards us. And of course, the reason is obvious. There is no electoral advantage in talking to voters about problems that lie ahead, but require higher taxes now. And the problem, I think we all know, Europe is getting much older. The problem we don't really look at is what this means for younger people. We sort of know that our children, and mainly our grandchildren, are not getting as good a deal as we of the post-war baby boom generation. We know intellectually, if you like, that housing is much more expensive. Wages are on the whole lower. Job security is much less. We sort of intellectually know these things, we of the older generations. But we don't think about how to confront it. So that's the reason for the book, to say, look, there is a tsunami wave of big problems coming towards us. It's Europe's demographic crisis. But it's not very visible. Yet it requires policies now if we're going to soften the impact on younger people.
You say it's not visible now, but the maybe conventional wisdom for people who aren't specialists is that the world is sort of overpopulated. It's reached, what was it, 9 billion, and it's not sustainable. And there'll be clearly imbalances, geographical imbalances. Obviously, the developing world is going through huge population increases. You're talking about the developed countries in the West.
Absolutely. I mean, we have this appalling mismatch between population explosions in Africa, which is going to double its population in the next 20 years. So by mid-century, one person in four, maybe one person in three, will be an African.
Right.
So that's a huge problem, how to find work for them, how to develop their economies. But it contrasts so sharply with the shrinkage of the richer countries. Mm. And yet we need their manpower. So the previous book I wrote was about immigration.
Yep.
And was why we need more migrants. We need fresh blood in Europe. We need bigger families. We need more people available for work. All of the things that the last 25 years have seen shrinking away before our eyes. Now, politicians like to say, oh, we've really reduced unemployment. Yes, of course they've reduced unemployment. It's because there aren't so many people to employ. Everybody knows there is a labour shortage in Europe. Walk down any high street around Europe and you'll see hiring now, looking for young people, hamburger jobs, any sort of jobs. Mm. People look at the sort of overall global population figures and say, ah, no problem. Not true. Europe has an enormous problem.
So the question then, though, is not the lack of work or the lack of employment. There are the figures support your thesis. It's the lack of well-paid jobs for younger people. Because you also say in the book, the governments need to find ways to encourage older people to stay in the job market, or at least to reskill and re-enter the job market after their earlier retirement. Isn't that part of the solution then?
Well, this is where it gets a bit complicated. People tend to think, and this is a very stubborn myth, that there is a finite amount of work to be done.
Right.
Of course, it's nonsense. Mm. People create demand and people supply demand. So the more people you have, the more your economy grows. When you start to have not enough people, your economy shrinks. And that is why, for the last 25 years or so, ever since this century began, we have seen almost zero growth, because zero growth in the workforce. And now the workforce is starting to shrink really fast. So this is where things get tough. During the post-war years, 1945 to 2000, let's say, roughly four people were in work for every pensioner. Ever since the new century began, that's been changing very fast. We're now at about one pensioner for around three people in work,
right.
Slightly less than three. Mm. But if you look at the European Commission's own figures, you will see that by 2060, there will be less than two people in work for every pensioner. Well, as the taxes paid by the people in work pay for the pensioners, anybody can see it's totally unsustainable. We're going bankrupt, as not just as countries, but as this hugely influential part of the world. And in this book, I've tried to look at three problems. I've tried to look at the aging problem, and therefore the unfair future of young people, as a sort of, if you like, a domestic European problem. I've also tried to look briefly at the consequences for the European Union. And thirdly, at the consequences, if you like, in geopolitical terms, of Europe's place in the world.
Right. You talk a lot, therefore, about Europe being less and less fertile. And you tend, if I'm not misrepresenting your arguments, to explain it in economic terms, these low-cost jobs. You've been talking about the unaffordability of housing and that kind of thing. But are there also, alongside those economic aspects, a social, societal, cultural change in the West, in Europe, though you talk a lot about the UK when talking about Europe as well, that young people just don't want to have more children anyway, even if they could afford it?
My impression, and I think we all have to work in generalizations here.
Yeah.
My impression is that young people today are no different to young people of any generation in history. Mm. They tend to like larger families, but they're unaffordable. So one of the chapters in my book is child homelessness equals childlessness.
Right.
And I think it's obvious. If you can't afford a nice big house or a big apartment in which you can have two, three, four kids, you're not going to have them. Add to that lower wages. Mm-hmm. It's quite expensive having children, we all know.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people now in their 30s actually can't afford more than one child. They can't house them. And quite likely the wife goes out to work.
Mm.
So she has to pay childcare that mops up all the available income. So all the cards are stacked against larger families. And this is an area where I think policy making really should be focused and say, what do we do about this? First thing is split off the care of the elderly from healthcare in general.
Right.
It's ridiculous. Yeah. We're burdening the hospitals with people who should be in care.
Yes.
Very different set of problems. And I think we should be looking at wages for younger people. I think there should be a higher minimum wage for people under 35. I think we should be looking at tax relief, really, really major tax reliefs for first-time home buyers. And of course, we should be building many more homes, because there's nothing like construction as a flywheel for economic development. We all know this.
Right.
And we're not doing it.
Well, you said at the beginning that you're suggesting that politicians know there's a problem there. They're not stupid, but it's too intractable. We know that the attempts by Emmanuel Macron in France, for example, to reform pensions and retirement age, and look at the success that has been, right?
Yes.
It is, in a sense, too intractable a problem, isn't it?
Well, the fact that it's hard to resolve as a problem doesn't make the problem go away.
Yeah.
On the contrary, it makes the problem greater, because the more you neglect a socioeconomic problem, the bigger it becomes. Again, why did I write the book? To try and persuade policymakers, people who think about these things, to bite the bullet, to say, look, it's not going to be easy. We're not flush with cash in Europe generally these days.
Yeah.
Older people have an inbuilt electoral majority, as far as we can see, forever. So politicians who come up with expensive solutions are at a high risk of being punished at the next election. Nevertheless, we have got to do this. And we have got to have, I think, cross-party consensus. Rather difficult when the far right is making such inroads into the political landscape. Yet at the same time, the time has clearly come for the centrist politicians to stand up and spell out the problem. And again, this another reason for the book. Nobody is spelling out the problem. Nobody is standing up and saying, look, this is the reality. You can talk about tugging the blanket of tax policies, social policies, from one side of the bed to the other. But you're missing the point. The point is that the whole edifice is starting to crumble.
You mentioned it just now, and it's a kind of sub-theme of your book, the grey lobby, the power of the older generation in politics, and how traditional parties, especially on the centre-right, but in centre-left as well, obviously accommodate, shall we say, to be diplomatic, the wishes of that older portion of the electorate, for obvious reasons, because they are regular voters, they know what their interests are, they can articulate them through the ballot box maybe more systematically than the younger people. I just wonder, to what extent does that translate into a sort of intergenerational conflict, that older people don't really care about the fate of young people? Paradoxically, because a lot of these old people are not just parents, they're grandparents. They must see the plight of their grandchildren, and they will therefore be a bit more open to these kind of radical reforms that you're suggesting.
Absolutely. How do we fix the problem? You remember, it's a bit of an old chestnut. Stalin was alleged to have said, one death is a tragedy, a million deaths is a statistic. Stalin, of all people.
He should know.
Yes, he should know. Translate that into our demographic problem. If for older people, older voters, we're looking at a statistic, they're not going to react. Mm. They're not going to do anything. They're not going to make any sacrifices. Mm. If we can somehow say, you are impoverishing your grandchild, you are making your children's lives unnecessarily difficult, then maybe if we can personalize the problem and get people to see it in family terms, maybe we can start to make some headway on this.
So let's talk about immigration briefly. As you say, with the subject of your previous book in 2021, another excellent book by you, Giles, do you think that it's about time that across Europe, including the UK, there was a more kind of grown-up conversation about immigration before it gets totally owned by these rather hard-right groups? Is now a good time to start that debate, the value of immigration?
Yes, I mean, it's high time, of course. It's very strange walking around different countries in Europe. I'm so struck by the degree of integration of people who are quite obviously not white indigenous Europeans. Mm. So in the last, 50 years, quietly, we have seen a sea change in the makeup of European society. It's white, black, brown, total mix.
Melting pot.
A melting pot. And yet, immigration has become the most bitterly fought over
toxic issue.
Why? Because we have allowed the far-right populists to inflame, I think, a very small number of people to create a sort of atmosphere of fear, resentment, whatever it is. And of course, it's because people are not as well off as they were. So they look to blame somebody. The awful thing is that we need so much more in the way of immigration than we have if we're going to confront the demographic problem. We also have to be much cleverer about how we treat migrants.
Yes.
Instead of seeing them as a burden, we must see them as generators of growth and wealth and economic activity.
Okay, let me ask you briefly about how, to what extent it is happening or it could happen more, that European countries, including the UK, can sort of help each other through, you know, so-called exchange of best practice. Do you see any evidence of that happening in a serious way? Countries just getting together and swapping ideas, seeing what works in one place or what doesn't work. You point out, to be fair, that there's no one size fits all for different European countries. Every country is different, but there are presumably some things where countries can learn from each other.
So far, the best practice exchanges seem to be between the far-right parties, not the more enlightened, the centrist left parties. This difference between countries is something that really does perturb me, because going back to the fall of the Berlin Wall and the decade afterwards, we in the European Union worked so hard to bring the former communist countries into Europe, and really rather successfully, I think. The problem, though, is that all this may be destroyed by the demographic problem, that the Central and Eastern European countries are losing population at a much faster rate than the Western European countries. So, first of all, countries like Romania, Bulgaria, and so on, have even lower birth rates than Southern Europe.
Right.
Which is saying something, because we're all down to 1.5 or less children per family. But not only that, their well-educated young people are attracted by higher wages in Western Europe.
Right.
So they're all going. The result is that Bulgaria, Romania, will be about a third smaller by mid-century than they are now. Now, it's tempting to say, so what? But if you're a third smaller, you are going to be much, much poorer. So all the efforts to stabilize those countries, which are now, if you like, frontline countries to Ukraine and all the problems there, are going to be weaker and weaker. So we've got a serious political problem inside Europe. And then there's a geopolitical problem.
Yeah.
If Europe as a whole is going to be really running into a brick wall on too few taxpayers for far too many pensioners. Mm. And we're going to see so much of our economies being devoted to social policies and healthcare rather than growth-promoting industrial policies. If that happens, Europe gets weaker and weaker. And I think Europe, at the moment, is showing itself to be a stabilizing force at a time when America has been overwhelmed by rather long-term uncertainties. So, for the sake of global stability, yeah. I think the Europeans really need to take this problem in hand.
Well, let's finish off then, Giles, by talking about the EU dimension as opposed to maybe the European dimension. In other words, the extent to which the European Union and its institutions and its competences, as they say in the jargon, can be part of the solution, not just be part of the problem.
Yeah.
We have, as you know better than I do, a European Commissioner for Demography. We have now also a European Commissioner for Housing, which is quite a novelty. But what role do you see? What are the limits of the contribution that the EU institutions can make to this issue?
Well, I hate to say this about the European Commission, but it's all talk. The Commission, as you mentioned, have no budgets. They have no Directorate General. They have no staff, no money. In which case, they're just window dressing. And I think the European Commission is really negligent in the way it has not confronted the demographic problem. The whole point of the Commission, the whole point of the European Union, is not only solidarity, it is the ability to look over the horizon and see if we can't, as Europeans, get together and have a common policy to confront a problem that people haven't yet woken up to.
Well, this van der Leyen Commission version 2 has only just started, right? It's a few months old, over 4 years left in its mandate. Is it too late? Has the die been cast and the talk will just carry on? Or is there scope for any kind of more constructive, proactive action from the Commission?
There's certainly scope, and it's never too late. On the other hand, in the real world, looking at it with a sort of skeptical journalist's eye, it's very difficult for any commission to be the leopard that changes its spots.
Right.
Von der Leyen has her way of doing things, and so far she's been pretty unshakable on a whole range of issues. That said, unless we have a common European approach, we won't fix anything, because different national governments need the alibi of solidarity. Mm. It's not just us,
yes.
It's the neighbour, it's all the other Europeans.
Yeah.
Not only that, as you touched on right at the beginning, there is best practice.
Mm.
Some countries do things better than others.
Right.
The Dutch, for instance, and the Germans are much better at things like healthcare for the elderly and childcare and so on. One of the ideas, which sounds a bit odd, I know, that I put forward was the idea of having a sort of colour-coded chart for each European member state and say, right, green on house building, they're building lots of houses, but brown on wage support,
right,
for younger people. I had in mind the things that you see in estate agents' windows,
right,
for people selling a house.
Does this sound dangerously, Giles, like naming and shaming a bit, like league tables?
Oh, not only dangerously, enthusiastically for naming and shaming. I mean, for all the years that you and I have both been in Brussels, I've said the Commission is lily-livered. I understand the political sensitivities and I reject them. That's what the Commission is for. That's why the Commission has a sort of copper-bound political status, name and shame, and really hold countries up to ridicule and criticism if they are not sticking to what they have signed up to. And what we've signed up to, what they've all signed up to, is to make the lives of their citizens better, not worse. Right now, we are on a slippery slope to real trouble. And I think naming and shaming is what is the first thing the von der Leyen Commission could usefully do.
Right. Well, we have to leave it there. Giles Merritt, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much. Great pleasure, Paul.